Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and editorial meeting. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on producing good food when we come back. You know, whenever students do well, schools happily claim responsibility. But when students do not do so well, school staff then say that they lack the ability, the motivation, or an academic background. Such hypocrisy shouldn't be allowed to go unchallenged. And furthermore, this disclaimer of responsibility amounts to saying that schools cannot make a difference. So why is it then that we're spending $500 billion a year, annually, supporting our public school system? Criticism of schooling precedes even the early beginnings of a public school system in the United States. That beginning occurred back in the 1830s with the enactment of the Common Schools Act in Pennsylvania and Horace Mann becoming Secretary of Education in Massachusetts. From a virtually inexhaustible supply, consider the reaction of some highly successful people in history and what they had to say about their schooling. Centuries ago, Cicero observed that the authority of those who teach is often an obstacle to those who want to learn. And growing up in the 19th century, Henry Adams, the grandson and great-grandson of our two presidents, John Adams and John Quincy Adams, said that he detested school and always regarded his days there as time thrown away. Ralph Waldo Emerson concluded that we are shut up in schools for 10 or 15 years, and we come out at least with a bag of wind, a memory of words, and we don't know a thing. President James A. Garfield said that it is a perpetual wonder to me that any child's love of knowledge survives the outrages of the schoolroom. And philosopher Bertrand Russell wrote that most children wish to know things until they go to school. In many cases, it is bad teaching that makes them stupid and uninquiring. In our own times, when Florida's teachers called their first statewide strike more than a generation ago, Governor Claude Kirk said, "Go ahead and close the schools for a year. 2 years from now, you'll never know the difference." One comment that you will not hear cited by admirers of the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. is when King said, "I have met more school teachers recently who wouldn't know a verb if it was as big as a table." MIT professor Gerald R. Zacharias concluded that the cities have been murdered by their schools, and if the schools were good, we could handle the other problems. And speaking of his own experiences, Woody Allen is cited as saying that he attended a school for emotionally disturbed teachers, and each morning he hugs his pillow because he doesn't have to go to school. Marlon Brando boasted that he was expelled from every school that he ever attended. And Jack Parr dropped out of high school because they weren't teaching him anything that he wanted to know. Walter Cronkite found that most classroom work was boring, for which he blamed uninspired teachers. And Cronkite particularly disliked how history was taught and believed that reducing this great drama to the rote of names, dates, and places ought to be treated as a crime. Rush Limbaugh regarded school as a prison, like purgatory. He went because, like countless numbers of students, he was told that he had to. But the process, he said, was total agony. Nor is the criticism limited to the United States or public schools. In Canada, Celine Dion hated school on her first day there, and she never changed her mind. In England, actor Anthony Hopkins regarded school as a complete anathema, where he didn't know what on earth anyone was talking about. He could have commiserated with Charles Darwin, who thought nothing could have been worse for the development of his mind than the school that he attended. George Bernard Shaw stated that there is nothing on earth intended for innocent people that is so horrible as a school, and the only time that my education was interrupted was when I was in school. Albert Einstein said that a short period that he spent in school resulted in his being unable to do any really creative work for several years afterward. From inside the system, John Taylor Gatto, the recipient of several individual awards as Teacher of the Year for New York City and New York State, said that school is a 12-year jail sentence where bad habits are the only curriculum truly learned. Musician Paul Simon began the lyrics of his hit song, Kodachrome, with, "When I think back on all of the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder that I can think at all." And yet, the system persists largely unchanged. Always remember that public school is the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto. You know, last time we were talking about producing good food, and specifically, we've been investigating the claims that are being made concerning bird flu, this avian bird flu. We see it on the news constantly. Hardly a week goes by now that we don't see something on the news that reminds us that somebody has died from avian flu or that birds have spread avian flu to a new location, a new country, whether it's Canada or Turkey or Austria or Sweden or someplace. It's certainly not good food to have it contaminated with some kind of a flu virus. In fact, poultry sales around the world are off. Poultry sales in the areas where this avian bird flu have been discovered are practically a disaster. In some cases, they're off 80%. In places in France, people have stopped eating chicken. But Laos, the little country, remember down in the Golden Triangle, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam. Can you remember that name Laos from the Vietnam War? Well, this little country of Laos is an exception. Laos is surrounded by countries like China, Vietnam, and Malaysia and Thailand, which have the avian bird flu, but the Laotians don't have it. Why is it that this country, this one country, right in the middle of the Golden Triangle, isn't having a problem with the avian bird flu when they're surrounded by neighbors who are? Well, the principal reason why Laos has not suffered widespread bird flu outbreaks like its neighbors is that there is almost no contact whatsoever between its small-scale poultry farms, which produce nearly all of the domestic poultry supply for the entire country, and its commercial operations, which are integrated with foreign poultry companies. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the poultry industry in Laos is predominantly one of small freeholders raising free-range local chicken breeds nearby their dwellings for meat and eggs, mostly consumed by the householders or sold locally for income. An average village has about 350 chickens, ducks, turkeys, and quail being raised in small flocks interspersed among village homes by about 70 or 80 families, with women primarily responsible for those flocks. Ducks, turkey, and quail are also raised, with negligible amounts of geese found scattered around the entire country. The few commercial operations found in Laos, less than 100 total, with 89 of these located near Vientiane, the country's capital city, in the country supply nearly nearby metropolitan areas, and biosecurity and technology utilization are minimal, with very little available veterinary care from either private or government sources. In other words, Laos is rife with free-ranging chickens mixing with ducks, quail, and turkeys and wild birds. And these are predominantly native chickens, which accounts for over 90% of Laos's total poultry production. Now, if free-range farming and migratory birds are in fact responsible for this spread of the avian bird flu, one would expect to find the disease raging across the country of Laos. But this has not happened. And in fact, the country's backyard farms have barely been touched. And according to the same USDA report, a total of 45 outbreaks were confirmed, with 42 of these occurring on commercial enterprises, broiler and layer farms, factory farms, 38 of these in Vientiane, the capital and primary city of Laos. Another 5 outbreaks were found in Savannetech province on one layer farm and in smallholder flocks, and another 2 in Campasic province on layer farms. Smallholders who found avian influenza in their flocks were located nearby these huge commercial factory farm operations suffering the disease. Laos effectively stamped out the disease by closing the border to poultry from Thailand and then culling chickens at the commercial operations. They were totally unconcerned about the disease spreading out from the affected farms because, unlike Thailand and Vietnam, small-scale farmers in Laos are not supplied by these big companies with day-old chicks or feed, and outside of the capital, poultry is produced and consumed locally. Poultry production is also more spread out in Laos. It is less dense, less integrated, and less homogeneous, all of which keeps bird flu from spreading and evolving into more pathogenic forms. The Laos experience suggests that the key to protecting backyard poultry and poultry flocks and people from bird flu is to protect them from industrial poultry and poultry products. This is relatively easy to do in a country like Laos, where there are very few factory farms in the country, little use of outside inputs, and essentially local food systems. It is much more difficult to extricate the industrial system from the small-scale poultry system in Thailand, Indonesia, or China, where both systems are so intimately integrated and connected by geography, markets, and production. In these countries, restructuring poultry production in ways that support small-scale operations requires a 180-degree turn away from intensive, integrated factory farming and globalized production. This is not, however, what the FAO and governments have in mind when they talk about restructuring. Now, if you'll remember last time, I mentioned this thing of monoculture. See, when I went to ag school many years ago, we practiced agriculture in America, not monoculture. Monoculture is the kiss of death in agriculture. But monoculture has a lot more profit to be made. I told you the last time about the economies of scale. There isn't any question, there isn't any doubt that one man who's taking care of 10,000 chickens is a whole lot more efficient than 100 men taking care of 100 chickens, or 10 men taking care of 1,000 chickens. However, when you diversify and you have one man taking care of 100 chickens over here, and then down the road there's a man and he's maybe raising cattle, and the next man down the road he's raising sheep, and the next man down the road is raising quail, and the next man down the road is raising something else. That's what we call biodiversity. That's like we see in the forest. I mentioned the forest experience here when an insect got into the oak trees here. They really thrive in oak trees, and then they'll kill every oak tree that they get into. But in the natural environment, the oak trees run out, and then there'll be a space where there's no oak trees because of a rock outcropping, and then you'll have cedar trees, and these insects don't affect cedar trees, they only affect oaks, and so the oak infestation stops then at the cedar trees. But when you plant all pine trees, like they do down in the south, they have to spray them every once in a while, because when an insect gets into the pine tree, which is designed to kill the pine tree, it just goes from pine tree to pine tree till they run out of pine trees, and there aren't any pine trees to run out of. Same thing is true with corn. Same thing is true with chicken, same thing is true with cattle. Monoculture is the kiss of death. Now, agriculture in the old days here in America, a man would have a few dairy cows, a few beef cows, a few sheep, probably have 1,000 chickens or 500 chickens. He would produce eggs and poultry, cattle and sheep, probably some turkeys, probably had some corn and wheat, probably had some truck crop, potatoes, and a few other things. In the process of doing that, he's practicing agriculture, not monoculture. And if a disease gets into, let's say, his wheat and destroys his wheat, it doesn't destroy him economically, because wheat maybe represents 10% of his entire crop, his entire farming operation. Today, however, wheat farmers do nothing but grow wheat. Corn farmers do nothing but grow corn. Soybean farmers do nothing but grow soybeans. If they get wiped out, if they lose their soybeans, they've lost 100% of everything. If a disease gets into soybeans, it goes from farm to farm to farm. That's what requires all of this massive spraying and all of this crisis management in agriculture. In Laos, where they practice agriculture rather than monoculture in poultry, the avian bird flu was quickly stopped and eradicated. But you cannot stop this avian bird flu as long as you have these monoculture factory farms. And that's what the world is turning to, monoculture factory farms. Monoculture is the kiss of death. Now go to Revelation chapter 6 and read about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. It isn't something that God necessarily has to do to us. It's something that we are doing to ourselves. It's just that there is an inevitable result that comes from it. If we continue on, and there's a choice here to be made, if we continue on this road to monoculture, which is exemplified by the genetically modified organisms and by companies like Monsanto and Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill and others, Americans want to live in cities like New York and Los Angeles, and they want somebody to produce their food for them. They don't want to produce food for themselves. In order for them to have somebody else produce that food for them at cheaper and cheaper prices or less and less money, they have to hire some guy who's got a profit motive. Multinational corporations like ADM have a profit motive. And after all, it makes all the sense in the world to try to produce food for less and less money, to compete in the marketplace, to satisfy the consumers in Los Angeles and New York. But the inevitable end to that experience and that experiment is going to be food shortages and famine. So says God himself. So says Revelation 6. I just thought I'd pass that on to you. Now, the people in Laos probably won't have that same problem. At least they're not going to have that problem in poultry. We have it here in the United States in our feedlots. And they're telling us now that they want, because of the monoculture of these big corporate feedlots and cattle, they want to register all of the cattle in the country, because it's very common now for cattle in California to be sold in Iowa, and cattle in Iowa that are born and raised in Iowa to be sold in Florida, or Texas, or Canada, or someplace else. This interstate and international transport of livestock is going to become a killer because diseases are no longer isolated to local areas. When I was a youngster in the Eel River Valley back in the 1930s, there was an outbreak of tuberculosis in dairy cattle. As a result of that, they had to kill some whole herds. But the outbreak was confined to the Eel River Valley. Today, cattle in the Eel River Valley are commonly sold in Tracy, California, or in Dubuque, Iowa, or in Austin, Texas. Those cattle that are being transported from the Eel River Valley in California, if they had tuberculosis or mad cow disease or something else, it would quickly spread to Texas or Iowa or Florida. So you see, when the government comes to us and says, we've got to come up with a national identification system where everybody in the country, including George Gordon and everybody else, has to register their cattle and their sheep so that the government can keep a national database so that when these sheep or cattle are sold in Missouri to somebody in Texas and it turns out that they have mad cow disease or black leg or tuberculosis, we can quickly and efficiently trace the ownership of the cattle, which may be turned up in Alamogordo, New Mexico, or someplace, back to George Gordon in Missouri. Makes all the sense in the world, doesn't it? But in the process of doing that, we lose agriculture and we replace it with monoculture, which is the kiss of death. We lose our freedom and our autonomy. We lose our sovereignty. We lose our property. And somebody from Washington is going to direct for us, like the Russians, in their famous five-year plans, how to raise sheep and how to raise cattle. And these policies will be made up of people who were born in New York, who are totally divorced from cattle, who went to college, and come out as thinkers, and they are going to make our policy for us. Not people who were born in Montana and who were raised with cattle, know and understand cattle, know and understand ranching, know and understand agriculture. Those aren't the people who will be making our policies in the future, or in fact, who are making our agricultural policy today. And there's a cute little saying in the Bible that says, when the blind lead the blind, they both fall in the ditch. So while it makes all the sense in the world to you city people, let me tell you that you are on the cusp of the kiss of death, which, by the way, tells me that there's nothing better in life that I can think of than food in a famine. Have you ever thought about great economic opportunity? You know, oftentimes when we talk about the Great Depression, we talk about the 25% of the people during the Great Depression years here in America who were unemployed. We don't talk about the 75% who were employed. We talk about people who were jumping out of buildings because they lost their fortunes, they lost their money. We don't talk about the people who took those people's fortunes and who took those people's property and who benefited from it and profited from it. And that's because we in the news business are out selling the exception. We're not selling the norm. We're selling the Boy Scout rapes old lady under pretext of helping her cross the street. Because that's novel, that's new, that's unusual. Boy Scout helps old lady cross street. That's not newsworthy. There's nothing in that act that we would want to report in the news. But Boy Scout rapes old lady after helping her cross the street. Now, that's newsworthy. So people jumping out of buildings, which is the unusual, which is the extraordinary, becomes newsworthy, profiting from those people who are jumping out of buildings. Well, that's normal. Everybody makes a profit. Everybody is connected with business. Everybody that buys, sells, and trades makes profit. Making profits in business isn't newsworthy. Losing everything that you've got is. So in the news business, we tend to exaggerate the negative. We always report the negative. The news always reports the war in Vietnam, or the war in Laos, or the war in France. That's what makes news. Today, it's the war in Afghanistan. It's the war in Iraq. That makes news. It's negative. You don't see anything positive. We don't report on those things that are positive. Well, listen to this. Back during the 1970s, an obscure black college professor at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, while working on a grant which was provided by the Rockefeller Institute or the Rockefeller Foundation, developed a unique marketing plan for agricultural products. The plan was aimed at poor, rural, black landowners in the South who owned small acreages. The goal was to keep these poor landowners on the land by producing produce for sale to the public at retail and to generate an income that would support a family. It was called the Whatley program, and it was so successful that it became known as the Whatley $100,000 per year on 25 acres or less program. The man's name was Professor Booker T. Whatley. Now, today, there are more than 4,000 of these small family enterprises operating all over the United States. Now, here at the law school, we have taken the Whatley program, and we have added the 15 agricultural laws of the Bible and the 17 financial laws from the Scripture, so that you can practice all of these laws of the United States, all of the laws of your state, and the laws of the Scripture, the laws of God, to make a good living for you and your family at the same time, no matter what your skin color. And in fact, it doesn't even take 25 acres. It's being done on as little as 3 acres in berry growing operations. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, and it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. And you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, my $100,000 a year class is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to our website now. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. That program deals with agriculture, not monoculture. Agriculture. Agriculture is where you grow more than one crop, and you grow crops, or you grow plants, or you raise animals in an environment that is complementary to one another. Raising cattle on a feedlot is not complementary to the landscape or to anything around it. It is, in fact, monoculture, the kiss of death. It stinks. It's filled with disease. And in fact, 100,000 head of livestock a year die in the United States in these feedlots. They're then taken off the feedlot and taken to rendering plants, where they are cut up, reprocessed, and then fed back to livestock again. You believe that? We take these ruminants and we turn them into cannibals. That's where mad cow disease comes from. It's these unnatural, unholy, illegal acts and operations. Acts and operations that are perverted, that make all the sense in the world. In other words, if you're born in New York City, and you go to college and you study biology and you learn about protein, and you say to yourself, gosh, look at all of this protein out here that we could feed back to these cattle. So back in the 1940s, when protein content was decreasing in grain, nobody asked the question, why is the protein content in grain decreasing? Some bright young kid from the Bronx went to college and said, hell, if protein content is decreasing in wheat, why don't we take the byproducts, the protein byproducts from the rendering plants or from the meat processing plants, dry it, grind it up, and feed it back to the cows to increase the protein content? Now, for those of you that are novices, a dairy cow has to have a feed ration with a minimum of 17% protein, or she can't milk. Now, in 1880, the average protein content of wheat coming out of Kansas was 24%. Way more than the 17% needed. But we found over the years that by 1950, the protein content of wheat coming out of Kansas by 1950 was down to 18%. What happened to those 8 percentage points? Well, God designed this program, this agricultural program, with a thing called land Sabbaths, where once every 7 years you let the land rest. You plant wheat on it for 6 years, and then in the seventh year you don't plant anything on it. You just let what grows there grow and let it die down. And that produces organic material, which is the natural method that God designed for fertilizing the land. Somebody went to college in Los Angeles, and they said, why should we lose 16% of our productivity? Why should we let the land rest once every 7 years when we can take a byproduct from the petroleum industry called nitrogen and put that on the land, and we can fertilize it with chemical fertilizers? It'll be a great boon to the petroleum industry, and it'll be a great boon to the farmers who use it. Makes all the sense in the world, doesn't it? Take a waste product out of the petroleum industry, turn it into nitrogen, potash, and potassium, and let's make a chemical fertilizer and put that on the land. And so you do, and it turns out beautiful green plants, and we put it on our corn and our wheat and our soybeans. My God, it just makes beautiful plants, beautiful acreages, beautiful farms. But there's a problem with it. You see, when you use chemical fertilizers, you get less and less of the protein and mineral content out of the plants that are being planted in the soil. Yeah, I'm just reporting to you that that's the way the game is played. So what happens is, as we use these chemical fertilizers, it makes beautiful plants, but they produce less and less protein, less and less iron and copper and boron and other trace elements in the plants. So the farmer doesn't get paid for the amount of protein that's in the wheat. He gets paid for the number of bushels and the number of pounds of wheat that he grows. You see, when a wheat farmer in Kansas plants wheat, and then he harvests the wheat and he sells it. If I were to plant wheat organically, let my land rest, and produce 24% protein wheat, when it gets down to the elevator, it all gets mixed in with the other guy's wheat that's 18% or 13% or 10%, and in some cases, wheat has a protein content of as low as 7%. National average now runs 7 to 13%, depending upon where it's grown. And that's because we use chemical fertilizers to grow it. We get more bins and bushels of wheat, but the nutritional content of those bushels and bins of wheat is less and less. So some bright young student from college, no doubt, probably raised in the city, comes along and says, we can boost the protein content by putting the waste products that come out of Swift's or Armor Star's meatpacking operation. So they go up here to the Swift Meatpacking Company in Dubuque, Iowa. And they find that all of the guts and the hides and the blood and all of these organic wastes that come out of cattle, I mean, you know, you don't eat the guts and you don't eat the blood. So they take all of that and they dry it and then they grind it up and they put it into the wheat and the corn and they make a dairy ration. And this dairy ration is 17% and the cows just milk like crazy. So you're taking a waste byproduct that comes from the meatpacking industry and then you're creating feed that you feed to the dairy cow, which then makes her give more milk, which makes the dairy farmer more profitable, but it creates mad cow disease. Mad cow disease then is spread to humans, and it's an incurable disease which kills you. So here we are taking a waste product from the petroleum industry to fertilize our land because we don't want to practice the land Sabbath. Then, when our protein content goes down, we take another waste product that comes out of the meatpacking industry, and we feed that to our cows and turn them into cannibals, which then gives us another disease called mad cow disease, which kills us, which now brings us to the point where we've got to solve the mad cow disease problem, so we've got to be able to track these cattle. So that means we've got to have a national identification system, which is a new bureaucracy administered out of the Department of Agriculture, which takes our freedom and sovereignty and our privacy away from us. Can you see how this makes all the sense in the world, doesn't it? I mean, after all, it's necessary. It's necessary because when you violate one law, like the land Sabbath, then it spills over into another problem which requires that we break another law, which then creates another problem which requires that we break another law which produces a greater problem. And one of these days, we get down to the wages of sin is death. I mean, that's the way the game is played, boys and girls, and this avian flu is simply an outgrowth of a criminal enterprise, a violation of the laws of God, so that in the final analysis, when it's all said and done, somebody comes along and says, my God, we've got avian flu, we need vaccinations. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but every year here in the United States, Americans get flu shots. That's because about 36,000 people a year die from the flu. So they go down and they get their flu shots. Now, when you get the flu shots, these flu vaccines have other additives, and these additives that are in the flu vaccines give you Alzheimer's disease. And so now we find that people over the past 10 years, if you got 10 shots for the flu over the past 10 years, you've increased your chances of getting Alzheimer's disease by about 80%. Doesn't mean that you're going to get it. Just means that your chances are a whole lot greater. And why is it that you get the flu? Because of the bad food that you eat. Now, producing good food requires good soil. And that's because good food comes out of good soil. Second, you have to have good seed, open pollinated seed. See, there's another little story that comes in here that I'll share with you. You see, in Leviticus 19, verse 19, God gave us a short, direct, pointed statute. It says, you shall not let your cattle gender with a diverse kind, that is, don't crossbreed your cattle. And you shall not plant mingled seed. Now, mingled seed is the old King James for hybridization. Hybridization. Hybrid seeds produce more bins and bushels of product than do old line open pollinated seeds. For instance, I've got some old line open pollinated blue corn that I got from an Indian in Taos, New Mexico, about 25 or 30 years ago. And this old Indian got that corn from his grandfather, who had raised that corn in 1939. 1939. And I took that corn, and the germination rate was 65%. And it was 50 years old when I got it in 1989. The corn itself was 50 years old. Today, if you sold seed that didn't have a 90% germination rate, which it'll have in the first year, they'd put you out of business. Fortunately, I didn't turn this old farmer in, this old Indian farmer, because I wanted the old line, open-pollinated Indian blue corn. 50 years old, still had 65% germination. I now have Indian blue corn. It produces 16% protein. 16% protein. Unheard of. You corn farmers out there, listen to me tell you, my Indian blue corn tests 16%, and you say, that guy Gordon's a liar. No corn that you can grow produces 16% protein. Oh, yes, there is. Additionally, we go back to the 1916 National Geographic magazine, and I was looking, I collect old National Geographic magazines. I have them back to about 1900. I don't have every issue back to 1900, but I got all of the issues back to about 1910, and then I've got most of the issues back to 1900, and I'm a collector, and I like to do that. It's kind of like collecting coins, you know. Well, I have to be looking at a 1916 issue of National Geographic magazine, and there was a man standing next in his garden. He was standing in his garden next to some corn, and on his shoulders was his wife, and she had her hand up over her head, and she could not touch the top of the corn stalk. In 1916, in Wisconsin, a man grew corn 16 feet tall. Now, you know, today, if you said, I've got corn that grows 16 feet tall, a corn farmer in Iowa would say, that guy Gordon's a liar. That's impossible. That can't happen. Well, certainly it can happen. It can happen on good soil with open pollinated seed. Land that is farmed according to the laws of God will produce it that way. Now, let me tell you another little story. A guy by the name of Faulkner wrote a book called Plowman's Folly back in 1943. And he said the moldboard plow designed by John Deere back in 1827 was designed to destroy soil fertility, not enhance it, which is exactly correct. You see, when the old timers, that is your great-great-great-great-granddaddy, came across the Appalachian Mountains, and they came down into the Ohio Valley and then across to Indiana and Illinois, they came into prairie land. They came into prairie land, buffalo land. And that land was virgin land, and it was so fertile, it had sod 12 inches thick. Sod 12 inches thick. They couldn't break through the sod. They couldn't farm it. When they dirt there, it was just biomass. Now, it wasn't all 12 inches thick, but there are reports of it being as thick as 12 inches. Just like there are reports in places in Iowa today where the soil is 6 feet deep. Now, it's not everywhere. The average around the world is about 6 inches, but there are places where there are soils 6 feet deep. There were places where the soil had sod on it 12 inches thick. So a guy named John Deere comes along and says, well, we got to have a way that we can cut through that sod, turn it up, and destroy it, kill it, so that we can get down to the dirt, so that we can plant crops. This is called virgin soil. In fact, the old-timers reported that the grass was so tall that it would hide a man sitting on a horse. Riding through the grass was taller than a man sitting on a horse. Now today, you make that kind of a report and people would say, well, that guy's lying. Grass doesn't grow 10 feet tall. Well, it used to, before we destroyed the soils, before we farmed all of the life out of the soils and then poisoned them with fertilizers. And then comes the spray story. You see, when you put on chemical fertilizers, it makes the plants really grow. I mean, they grow, and they grow, and they're dark green, and they're wonderful plants. But they lack nutrition. They lack protein. They lack copper. They lack iron. They lack trace minerals. Well, insects were designed by God to destroy weak plants. If you want to test it, you take a guy that's an alcoholic, and you sit him down in the woods, and the ticks just cover him. Take another guy that's not an alcoholic, and the ticks don't get on him near as bad. They probably get on him, but not near as bad. You take a guy that smokes, and he goes out into the forest, and the ticks just get after him. See, parasites are attracted to weak hosts. Parasites do not attack strong hosts, weak hosts. So if you're wondering why mosquitoes bother you, it's because you smell real good to a mosquito, and so he attacks you. If your body is in good physical condition, and you're not lacking in vitamins and minerals, the mosquitoes don't bite you. And that's just real special. neither do the ticks. I happened to be down in the woods one day, and my wife, who's a health food nut, you know, she's pretty attuned to this thing of nutrition, one thing and another. We're down in the woods, and there was a rock wall down there built by an old black guy back in Civil War times, right after the Civil War. So we sat on this old rock wall, and we're talking about this old dry rock wall like they built over in Ireland. And while we were sitting there talking, a tick got on me, and I reached over, and I pulled this tick off, and I smashed him between my thumbnails, and I killed him. And so we're talking along some more. Pretty soon, another tick's crawling on me, and I picked him off, and I killed that one. And pretty soon, another one was crawling up my leg, and so I took that one, and I killed him, and then another one's crawling on my other leg, and I killed that one. And I'm sitting there, and pretty soon, after about 5 minutes, I mean, I'm picking ticks off of me, just one right after another, and I'm just killing ticks just as fast as I can pick them up and kill them. Now, my wife is sitting there watching all this, see, as I'm sitting here killing these ticks, and I'm pulling them off, and one thing and another, says, God, these ticks down here in the Ozarks are something terrible. So I just moved out here, and I was from Idaho, you know, where we didn't have very many ticks, and I'm killing these ticks. I killed about 36 ticks, as I recall, in about 5 or 10 minutes. And she looked over at me and she says, God, you're sick. God, you are sick. And I said, why do you say that? She says, well, I've been sitting right here next to you, and I haven't taken a single tick off of me. And I looked over at her and I said, well, by God, you're right. Why, you haven't taken a single tick off of you, and we're sitting right next to each other, and I've killed 36 ticks, and here's another one. And I'm reaching down. In fact, I said, let's get the hell out of here. And she says, well, where are you going to go? These ticks are a natural part of the ecological balance here. These ticks, these 36 ticks that you just killed here, aren't unique to this one spot on this farm. You can move over here 100 feet, and there's another 36 ticks. You can move over here a half a mile, and there's another 36 ticks. These ticks are everywhere. And I said, well, why is it that they're not getting on you? And she says, well, because my body's balanced. Because I eat foods that have vitamins and minerals in them, and you don't. You've been eating out of the supermarket. You've been eating out of the restaurant. You've been eating the national American diet. And she was right. Today I can go down in the woods and sit down anywhere. Ticks don't get on me. Now, once you come here from Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York, and the ticks will pick you up and take you down to the lake to eat you for lunch. Now, that's not something that's novel or unusual. It isn't something that isn't known. It's something that we don't teach. It's something that we don't report. It's something that we don't tell you, because if you people knew and understood the natural balance, you might want to buy that. It might be a better program. Now, if you want to buy Brussels sprouts and broccoli out of the grocery store, that's fine. But they're deficient in nutrients because the farmers that grow them use hybrid seeds in violation of Leviticus 19:19. As a result of that, those plants will not pick up as much in the way of, none at all, but they will not pick up nearly as much as an open pollinated seed will. Let me give you a little story here when we talk about subsistence and survival. A fellow by the name of Adolf Steinbrunn. See if I can find Adolf Steinbrunn in here. Maybe that Adolf is over here in this other section. Hang on. Here it is. Back during World War II, our parents and grandparents planted victory gardens, and they helped to provide their own food and fiber for themselves and for our country. But today, over half the food that we eat in this country is imported from outside of our borders. Our food is being produced from hybrid seed that will not reproduce, and it is nutritionally deficient. Now, it really doesn't make any difference whether this nutritionally deficient food comes from Mexico, grown on some multinational corporate farm owned by ADM, or by Tyson Foods or somebody else, or whether it's produced here in the United States. These hybridized seeds produce deficient food. Now, Adolf Steinbrunn of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter into perspective by having samples of corn tested for nutrients that are usually added to commercial feeds, and when compared to more than 4,000 samples of hybrid corn. Now, listen, we're not talking about 5 or 10 samples here. 4,000 samples were taken and tested. 4,000 samples of hybrid corn tested in 10 Midwest states in a recent year. Steinbrunn's open pollinated corn contains 75% more crude protein, 875% more copper, 345% more iron, 205% more manganese. And the same result was seen in the content of calcium, sodium, magnesium, and zinc. In fact, boys and girls, every nutritional element will be less in hybridized seed than in open pollinated seed. And when you grow it with commercial chemical fertilizers, it will be less. And then the insects attack the plants because they have nutritional deficiencies, just like the ticks attack people that have nutritional deficiencies, because parasites, of which insects are parasites, and they attack weak plants. And it's designed that way. It was designed that way by God to protect you. But you see, when you're born in the city and you go to college, it makes all the sense in the world to see an insect as a predator, as an enemy, as something that needs to be destroyed, not as a part of a living, balanced biological biosphere. No, ticks are parasites and they need to be exterminated. Corn borers are parasites that need to be exterminated. And so when you go to ag school, they say, well, my God, corn borers are bad. That's because they bore into the corn and they destroy it. Well, of course, corn borers bore into the corn and destroy it. When you grow corn on nutritionally or nutrient deficient soils, then the corn is nutrient deficient. And if you eat that nutrient deficient corn, then your body will become nutrient deficient and you'll get sick and you'll get cancer. Or you'll get muscular dystrophy or Parkinson's disease or Lou Gehrig's disease or something else. Well, my God, you could get avian bird flu. And so people react by wanting to kill the corn borer. The corn borer, when you see one in your corn, it's telling you that the ground, the soil, is nutritionally deficient. You need to work on the soil to build it up. Now, that's where the real news is, and that's what producing good food is all about. Good food, boys and girls, begins with the soil. It begins with the practice of agricultural practices described by Moses, given to Moses by God Almighty himself, because this is the way the machine works. It's the way the game is played. Play it that way, and everything works out fine. But if you don't play it that way, well, then it gets to be more expensive. And one of these days, you'll come down with avian bird flu, and you will curse God, and you will say, why did God let that happen to me? And it's because you wouldn't have it any other way. Well, we're about out of time, boys and girls. I got to leave it right there. We'll take it up right here again tomorrow night, same time, same station. Remember, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and The Law Hour is an education service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. Got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.